We talk about the Bible like it's one book, when in fact it's actually more like a whole library condensed into one volume. All those many books have many different authors who were writing across many centuries and had different audiences in mind. So just like we wouldn't read a book of poetry the same way we'd approach a fable or a history book, maybe it doesn't make sense to just plow through the good book like it's all one thing. The key is context, whether we're reading the Bible as an expression of faith or just to know what's in this book that billions of people hold sacred. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Kristen Swenson is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University and a fellow at Virginia Humanities in Charlottesville. She knows the Bible backwards and forwards. She's fully aware of its beauty and wisdom, and also of all the maddening ways it contradicts itself. And she actually says she loves it in part because of the very flaws and mysteries it contains. Swenson's new book is called A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. Kristen, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Right off the top in your book, you tell us you love the Bible and also that the statement itself makes you a little uncomfortable. Why is that?
Yes. Well, I think sometimes people talk about a love for the Bible that assumes that it is this crystalline clear collection of inspiration and lofty thoughts and powerful deep wisdom, all of which it is, but it is also a very messy book. And my love for the Bible is a love that reflects on its messiness. That is, it is because of some of the messiness of the Bible that I'm most fascinated by it.
It seems as if in your book, you're trying to reach people who view the Bible as a sacred religious text, as well as those who don't see it that way, who might just come to it as an important collection of works with extraordinary influence on human history. What are the challenges to speaking to both audiences simultaneously?
Well, the wonderful thing about this topic, the strangenesses of the Bible, is that it doesn't matter what you believe. I think pretty much anyone who has read any bit in it will have experienced that, will have witnessed how strange the Bible is. So the strangenesses of the Bible, I think, kind of crosses that faith, not faith, belief, unbelief line. People who may have grown up with the Bible in a condition of their religious experience, their people of faith, Christians or Jews, will likely have read along and thought, been struck by something that seems odd, or suddenly a story takes a turn they didn't think it would, or drops off when they're most getting interested in one thing or another. And similarly, folks who don't necessarily believe in the Bible at all, but recognize that it is important through history as this sacred text, have seen some of those oddities. And sometimes people dismiss the Bible because of those. But I think it's just so clear to folks pretty quickly on encountering the Bible that there are strangenesses within it, to be maybe open to talking about those.
I want to talk more about this idea that the Bible is not one thing. How different are the texts of the Hebrew Bible and the Protestant and Catholic Old Testaments?
Yeah, so you bring up a really important point. That is that when we talk about the Bible, we may not all be talking about exactly the same thing. That is, the Bible for Protestant Christians has simply less in it than the Roman Catholic Bibles. So Roman Catholic Bibles are based in large part on the Septuagint, a Greek translation of the Hebrew text that circulated before the canon of the Old Testament was, or the Hebrew Bible even, was firmly established. And so we have a corpus of sacred text that differs depending on faith traditions. One of the most striking examples of that is the Book of Esther. In the Hebrew Bible, the book of Esther doesn't actually mention God. The Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint, included quite a bit about God. And so Roman Catholic Old Testaments will have God in the book of Esther, where Protestant Christian Old Testaments will not. So yeah, there's some really interesting differences between those canons. And that can make, of course, a difference in the ways that people think about, think about things based in their beliefs.
Most of us today read the Bible in our native language, but, the languages in which the original texts were written are mostly dead or have evolved so much as to make them utterly unfamiliar. So in other words, that biblical Greek is not the same as modern Greek. What do we need to understand about how translations have been performed from these original languages?
Yeah, so translation, of course, is itself an act of interpretation. I think anybody who has studied a foreign language has bumped into this. That is, try as you might to have what we might think of as a perfect translation, a one-to-one correspondence between the two languages, the original and the language into which one is translating, it is not always possible. And so with the biblical texts, we face, just as you said, the challenge that the original languages are themselves very strange to us. And yes, in the case of both the Hebrew and the Greek, are so ancient as to be different than the modern expressions of those languages today. And so the ways that people translate has great bearing on our understanding of those texts. And sometimes people will ask me, what's the best translation? To which I have to say, I think they all are together. That is one way to deal with the problem of not being able to read those original languages for yourself is to gather just as many different translations as you can and lay them out side by side. The internet makes this easy for us to do. We can actually pull up parallel translations of biblical text and see where they differ. And usually the ways in which they differ reflect the ways in which the original languages might allow for different translations. Sometimes they differ because the editors or the translators have very particular ideas about what they think that text really means. And so they'll choose language that reflects the meaning that they have discerned as or decided is the most authoritative. But I think it can be helpful to have a lot of different translations in front of a person at the same time.
Are most of us today reading a translation of a translation?
Yes. And actually, you mentioned, gosh, Chris, your questions are great. I just have to
thank
say,
you.
Wow. Yeah, thank you. So you mentioned accurately that these languages, the original languages out of which the biblical texts that we have come, are themselves now dead. But they, within the texts themselves, reveal evolution. So folks who have spent years and years and years studying ancient Near Eastern languages, for instance, can tell you some of the archaic Hebrew of the ancient biblical Hebrew by comparison with more with later Hebrew, all within the Hebrew Bible. And similarly with the New Testament, although the books of the New Testament, these Greek texts, didn't evolve over such a long period of time. That is, their writing and their canonization, their authorship and the point at which they became Bible was much shorter than the books that compose the Christian Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. But I think I might have digressed from your question. Oh, translations of translations. Yes, we may well be reading translations of translations. And the best example of that is perhaps that for a long time, it was a Latin translation of the Greek Hebrew Bible, for the sake of argument here, that was the standard for Roman Catholic Christians, and that Vulgate was itself then a translation of translation. It starts to get a little slippery, though, because we're not entirely sure with some of the books of the Hebrew Bible, the sort of the chronology of canonization for the finalization of books. But boy, that's a lot of isations. Maybe enough for now.
Well, is there a definitive original text from which modern translations derive?
That would be great. We actually don't have an original Bible, which can be quite earth-shattering for folks. I know it was for me when I learned that. I thought, well, how then in the world can we determine an authoritative text? But we do have very ancient copies of these ancient books. We also know that, so one of the strange things about the Bible is that it evolved over a long period of time. And you mentioned that in your introduction, which was great, that the Bible didn't come into being wholesale in one moment from one hand. And then we can just refer to that whenever there's a question, go back to the original. But it evolved over a long period of time. Some of the books themselves evolved over a long period of time. And we don't have an original, but we do have the means of comparing ancient, very ancient texts against one another. The discovery of fragments of texts from the Dead Sea, around the Dead Sea, from the archaeological site of Qumran, was a watershed moment in biblical scholarship that provided folks with a whole lot more of ancient texts, these from, you know, the early centuries of the Common Era, against some of which were texts that reflected texts that would become Bible. We could compare against what we had been using as Bible. That was it's been very instructive.
Why are so many books of the Bible given names of people not assumed to have actually written them?
Yeah, it was a way of giving, we think anyway, it was a way of giving some authority to the literature itself. There didn't seem to be as much interest in having one's name on a book, like my name on this book. In the ancient world, it was more important that the name on a book be widely recognizable, and of course have some association with the reputation or with the theme of that book, the reputation of the name given to it. So I think about like the Hebrew books of the prophets, we do think some of those may well have come from those prophets, but some of them may have come from schools of those prophets, later folks. And then of course the Gospels in the New Testament have names of folks who may very well not have had any part in their writing, but the reputation of those folks was important to assign to those texts.
What do we know about how biblical texts were amended and edited over time, and to what purpose those things happened?
Oh, it's such a fascinating study, and it's endless. It depends on which ones we're looking at. One of the things that was so illuminating for me when I was studying this in such depth in the doctoral program was how important the Babylonian conquest of Judah was in the shaping of the Bible. And then in Cyrus the Great of Persia's release of those folks from exile in Babylon, the Jews from their exile in Babylon, in the development of the Bible. These are things that sound, oh my gosh, I can just see folks' eyes glaze over the radio, Babylonian exile. But the thing is, it was an absolute crisis of theology and, of course, the nation when this great world powerhouse of Babylon defeated the little nation there in against the Mediterranean of Judah in the 6th century BC, so we're in 587 BC, the Babylonians defeated Judah. The narrative had been that God had chosen this people who settled that land specially, and that God would always be present to them through the temple in Jerusalem. And not only that, but that someone from David's line would always be king in Jerusalem. When the Babylonians defeated Judah, they, of course, ended that monarchy, and they raised the Jerusalem temple. So R-A-Z-E-D, in other words, they destroyed it. And so that was hugely problematic for ideas of God's strength, God's presence, God's interest in this people, God's veracity. Did God lie by saying that God? So a lot of what we find within the Hebrew Bible is a reckoning with that crisis, a trying to figure out how it could be that the people would suffer such a humiliating defeat, and that God would, and what happened with God in that. So we see traces quite clearly of editing, especially in the books, we call them of the Deuteronomistic history. They're books of history, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, that were definitely redacted after that event in order to kind of help us think differently about it, help people then think differently about the prophets as well. And then all of those literary initiatives and those efforts to make some theological sense of that crisis inform the New Testament and ideas about Jesus as well. So anyway, that's a question we could go into great detail on for a very long time. And it is fascinating.
The simplified understanding of the Bible says it portrays the God of the Old Testament as vengeful and angry, and the God of the New Testament as loving and forgiving. You say a close reading challenges both those interpretations.
Yes. Yeah. And I think so. One of the things I want to do with this book is give people pause from that sort of instinctive reaction we have to say the Bible says this and that's that. End of story. The Bible has so many different kinds of literatures and so sometimes competing ideas, even about God. And in the Old Testament, I use Old Testament and Hebrew Bible somewhat interchangeably. The Christian Old Testament, the first part of the Christian Bible, is composed of books that were almost exclusively written in biblical Hebrew. So we sometimes call them the Hebrew Bible, and those are books that compose the Jewish Bible, Jewish biblical canon of Tanakh. Anyway, for our readers and listeners, I want to be sure I'm making some sense here. And now I lost my train of thought.
We were talking about angry Old Testament God versus loving New Testament God.
Yes, yes, yes. So there are all these different images of God that we have within the Hebrew Bible, which is a big collection. It's bigger than the books of the New Testament. And within it, we have all sorts of different images of God. Yes, there is a God of judgment and wrath. And now that relates to some of what I was talking about with respect to making sense of that tremendous Babylonian exile. In order to make sense of it, one way was to say we had it coming to us. So we get a God who had to punish, and that would make some sense of that tremendous crisis. At any rate, you also, though, have within the Hebrew Bible these images of God as like a parent carrying the child, or this God who is deeply in love, like a spouse of their partner, this people. So we have really beautiful images of God's compassion and forgiveness and love within the Hebrew Bible. or the Old Testament. And we also have a pretty scary looking God in parts of the New Testament. I think about the book of Revelation and some of the judgment and the fantastical imagery of comeuppance that we find within Revelation. And then, of course, also Jesus had some hard things to say about doing right in the world and how the consequences of that and not doing that.
Does the Bible tell us to beat our swords into plowshares or our plowshares into swords?
You have read closely, yes, a bit of both, right? Hmm. We have a couple of texts within the books of the prophets from the books of Isaiah and Micah. We have identical, those wonderful texts of peace. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And actually, I love Micah adds a little bit about everybody sitting under their own fig tree. Micah was likely a fellow from a pastoral area. At any rate, we have those, but we also have in the book of Joel exactly the opposite verbatim, that they shall beat their plowshares into swords and their pruning hooks into spears. So we see within that actually another example of the way the Bible is talking to it. It has a conversation within itself. And I love this because it invites us into the conversation. I think it dignifies our questions. One of the things that I think we tend to do when we come to the Bible is assume that we just have to sit back and take it, whatever it says, is we just sit and listen. But this example of these texts, as well as so many others in which we have competing ideas of God, for instance, invite us into the conversation. They invite us as readers, whatever we believe, to question, to engage, to think for ourselves. This is one of the things, again, that I love about the Bible.
So you have in the Bible a call for a monotheistic religion, right? There is one all-powerful God, but it creates some problems because who are you supposed to blame all the bad stuff on? Let's talk about Satan.
Okay. We've got a word that we use as a proper name, Satan, as the personification of evil. That is all well and good, but it's not the whole story. That word is actually a word that we get. It's a transliteration from Hebrew that we find within the Old Testament of usually it's pronounced the Satan, and it often appears with a definite article or an indefinite article. So we don't know whether to capitalize that word or not when we encounter it. The Satan in the Old Testament actually functions as a kind of prosecuting attorney. So our earliest references to the Satan are as a figure who actually is part of, and here's the problem with radical monotheism, is a part of God's entourage. There are other heavenly beings that we encounter within the Hebrew Bible without apology and no explanation. It's just assumed that listeners or readers would accept that there are other heavenly beings. Among those heavenly beings might be the Satan. This we find in the book of Job, for instance, references to the Satan as among the heavenly beings who in that book performs this accusatory function that isn't necessarily bad. Although the Satan is like a prosecuting attorney within the Hebrew Bible. We also actually have a couple of references to God as the Satan, or the angel of God is a Satan. So that's maybe, and we find this in the book of Numbers, a very strange story with a talking donkey, in which the angel of God, or this messenger, this divine messenger, assumes the function of the Satan. And so it's only quite a bit later, we're heading centuries ahead to the influence, some maybe of Zoroastrianism, But this inclination to divide the world into clear black and white, good and bad. And at that point, the Satan begins to take on shape, if you will, as a bit more of the thing that we recognize today as an active, evil, problematic devil is actually a word that comes from the Greek translation of the Satan, diabolos. So the Satan evolves into Satan only over the course of centuries. And we see some of that evolution, the fingerprints of that or the footsteps of it in the Bible.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, what about hell? How specific are the descriptions of this place, and who does the Bible tell us might end up there?
Yeah, so we have far less about hell than we might like to know in the Bible. And the same actually goes for heaven. There isn't a reference to hell in the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. There we might read of Sheol as the land of the dead. Hell shows up for us in the New Testament, and it's more associated with this kind of a repulsive place just outside of Jerusalem. So we don't have the kind of fire and brimstony hell in the Bible spelled out in quite the ways we modern and our modern imaginations have taken. But there is a good bit of fantastical imagery also in Revelation that has informed some of our ideas of judgment and the afterlife and hell. But yeah, it's not nowhere near as detailed as we have gotten over time.
So some of that is just the interpretation we've received from religious leaders and people who are trying to help us get a picture of all this.
Yeah, and it points to something else about the Bible, and that is, again, it's sort of invitation to engage with it. Can mean that then we extrapolate from and reinterpret in our own circumstances what we're reading there. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with that, but I do urge folks to kind of know when we're doing it. That is, for instance, with like the Satan, to know when we're imagining based on or out of the biblical texts.
Kristen, there are some, for lack of a better word, plot holes in the Bible. The first one that trips people up is where the wives of Cain and Abel, sons of Adam and Eve, could have come from. Why do you think the Bible makes no effort to solve this question that surely would have occurred to anyone who has ever heard the story of Cain and Abel?
Well, I think that in that question maybe lies the answer. That is, maybe they didn't really care that much. Maybe because I firmly believe that whoever's responsible for the final form of the Bible as we have it were very smart people who were very well informed in their world, and they then made choices. And so they also would have seen that this wouldn't jive as a kind of chronological narrative. So maybe they were up to something else. Maybe they were interested in telling different kinds of things. So I think that again, we have to sort of check our modern sensibilities a little bit at the door. That is, or recognize when our modern sensibilities may lead us to assume the Bible should say or do a certain thing when in fact it does something quite else and try to take it on its own terms.
What happened to cause the versions of the Bible that we have today to be declared finished so that no other alternative books were considered for canonization?
Yeah, it took that also took place over a period of time. We think that for a while folks had an idea that it was there was a particular moment when a bunch of guys sat down and said this is in and this is out. And there may have been some of that along the way, but the books that got in, so to speak, were in for a reason. Many of them had been authoritative and the the text that the communities of faith return to over and over and over again. So they bubbled up as shoo-ins. Others, there was some question about. I mentioned Esther and how the Hebrew Bible Book of Esther doesn't mention God. Seems that might have taken a little while to come round for acceptance. The New Testament process, I think, went a little faster than that. And again, the writing of those books developed more quickly. But in general, the same sorts of rules applied. That is, the books that continued to really resonate with the faith communities seem to have been the ones that were finalized as Bible. But it was, again, it was not an absolute moment in time.
You mentioned the Book of Esther, and I want to talk a little bit about historical context and why that's so important. I mean, it can be, as a modern 21st century woman, one can open the Bible and not find a lot of encouraging content with regard to the things that I ought to be allowed to do.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the a common through line in the biblical literature is that it reflects a patriarchal context. And that is just the way it is. Now, that doesn't mean that women's perspectives and women's experiences are not represented at all. They are, and there are some really interesting and complicated women that we encounter. Esther is one of them. We also have, this wonderful, beautiful Book of Ruth. We have reference to Mary Magdalene is a really interesting person in the New Testament for her identification with Jesus, as she seems to have been among the apostle leaders of Jesus' group. So there's some really amazing women, but yeah, there are fewer references to women in the Bible. And also, there are a number of texts that simply assume a male audience. A lot of the legal texts we run into assume that the audience to whom these will apply are men.
Because women wouldn't have been taught to read under almost any circumstance?
We don't know that for sure, but for a time, I think folks were hopefully thinking that actually, there was a book I remember came out some time ago, imagining that one of the authors contributing to what we have in the first five books of the Bible was a woman. But yeah, women probably didn't have the same kinds of access to learning that men did.
Why do so many people think Mary Magdalene was a prostitute or some kind of fallen woman? Is there any direct reference to that in the text that we have?
No, is the short answer. That's an idea that came about because of conflating the named Mary Magdalene with an unnamed woman who is associated with prostitution. And I can't remember which pope it was that really brought those together, stories to tell that Mary Magdalene had been a prostitute. I can't remember the pope right now. But yeah, that was a product of Christian tradition that Mary got the reputation of having been a prostitute, but there isn't anything expressly naming her that or describing her as that in the Bible.
When we talk about, context in the Bible in history, at the time that sort of biblical actors were walking the earth, there wasn't a differentiation between the realm of religion and the realm of the natural world or politics or society. Why is it important for us to keep that in mind as we read the Bible?
Yeah, so that's right. We don't get references to religion per se within the Bible. I think it's important because we tend to use religion as a Well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that I find so useful and valuable about looking at what's strange in the Bible is that it can, and these places where the Bible disagrees with itself in particular, that we then might hesitate from declaring that we have the right answer and the other people are wrong, and using the Bible as a weapon against others. So one of the things that I think is helpful in seeing how the Bible is sometimes gets around our expectations, or again, maybe disagrees with itself or challenges our assumptions, is that then we may be less inclined to beat other people up with it. And I think when we start using religion, sometimes religion we can use as a shorthand for right and wrong. And whatever my religion dictates is then the right way, and others are wrong, and therefore are subject to punishment. And I think it's worth our pausing before we weaponize the Bible like that.
It's one thing to consider the inconsistencies in the Bible if we're reading it without feeling the need to believe what it says. What do believers gain by recognizing that there are multiple sources of its writing, that it is designed, perhaps, maybe that's the wrong word, to be read as if in conversation?
Yes, I think they gain a great depth to their faith. So I come from a perspective of faith. I was raised, born and raised Protestant Christian, Lutheran to be precise, and I continue to identify as Christian. For me, thinking about those characteristics of the Bible that you lay out enriches my faith. It allows me to believe that God may still be talking. If this is God's word, who says it had to be fixed and that there is no further engagement with it? On the contrary, I can accept it as an invitation, and as a person of faith, I can accept it as an invitation from a very complicated God who defies our expectations, an invitation to be in relationship to this, with all that that comes with, to argue with it, to be engaged with it in ways that may be comforting and inspiring, but also can be challenging.
Kristen Swenson is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Virginia Commonwealth University and a fellow at Virginia Humanities in Charlottesville. Her book is called A Most Peculiar Book: The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. Kristen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. This was great fun.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.